Long before we had the Bitcoin energy debate, we had the gold resource cost debate. The contours were similar. The costs associated with gold refining and extraction were a waste. They were too great relative to a mere fiat standard in which notes could be printed for virtually nothing. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, the Scott Horton of the Bitcoin world, for those of you who know and love Scott Horton. We have an awesome one from today, and we are reading, of course we're reading today, another one from Bitcoin Magazine, this time by Nick Carter. This is actually his first piece published on Bitcoin Magazine, if I am not mistaken. And cool story, you can actually listen to this one on YouTube. So I've been working with BTC Media or Bitcoin Magazine to have the audio version actually published with the article on YouTube now. So they've just been publishing so much great stuff. And I don't even think I'll be able to, based on like how much they're pumping out, I might even not be able to get them on the show. So be sure to go to the Bitcoin Magazine YouTube channel because there might actually be articles up there that you can listen to read by me in audio that don't actually make it to this show. They've been spreading the Bitcoin Audible content far and wide for all platforms to enjoy. And they've just been absolutely killing it with content lately. I can seriously barely keep up with it. But today's article is prime for making sense of the mining is bad for the environment, mining wastes energy debate. And not only is this not a new debate, Nick Carter argues here, it's not actually the debate that we think it is. It's a framing of something that's been an age-old debate that's been going on and has started even with gold. Now, before we get into it, let's thank our two amazing sponsors, SwanBitcoin.com/guy, for your automatic Bitcoin savings plan. I have been stacking like a mofo through all of this quote-unquote dip in the past few months, taking serious advantage of this, and it has paid off pretty massively already. Automatic buys and automatic withdrawals to your keys. It's really hard to beat. That is SwanBitcoin.com/guy. And honestly, speaking of your keys, our other sponsor, Shift Crypto, has the BitBox O2 hardware wallet. They are the solution to the keys problem. You want to know you're in possession of your Bitcoin and that they are secure from the clutches of the hackers, the malware, and the faulty hard drives of the world. So get yourself an intuitive, secure, reliable hardware wallet, the BitBox O2, and, you know, get a 5% discount with code GUY while you're at it. Discounts are basically the bomb. Check them both out. Both of our amazing sponsors at GuySwan.com. With that, let's get into today's read, and it's titled, "The Bitcoin Energy Debate is a Modern Reprise of the Gold Resource Cost Debate," by Nick Carter. The debate over the resource cost of gold is critical in understanding the present-day fixation with Bitcoin's energy costs. And the answers remain the same. Long before we had the Bitcoin energy debate, we had the gold resource cost debate. The contours were similar. The costs associated with gold refining and extraction were a waste. They were too great relative to a mere fiat standard in which notes could be printed for virtually nothing. Why bother with gold, impassive and unwavering in its supply dynamics, when you could have the cheap and highly configurable paper standard instead? The critique hinges on figures computed by economists finding extremely high resource costs associated with the gold standard. Infamously, in his 1951 essay, Commodity Reserve Currency, Milton Friedman criticizes the gold standard on these grounds, calculating that 1.5% of GDP would have to be devoted to the production of gold under a full reserve standard. an estimate he revises up to 2.5% in 1960. Writing in Cato Journal in 1999, Alan Meltzer replicates Friedman's analysis and, while conceding that Friedman's estimates are a shade aggressive, nevertheless concludes that, quote, "the resource cost of a full commodity standard remains high." As George Selgin notes, contemporary economists continue to maintain that a gold standard is expensive relative to fiat. Selgin provides the example of Starr claiming in 2013 that, quote, "the use of paper or fiduciary money instead of commodity money is resource saving." The lineup of critics is completed, if somewhat diminished, by the addition of Matt Iglesias reminding us that the gold standard would, quote, "impose a cost on the real economy, as the gold held in bank vaults is gold that is not available for industrial or decorative uses." According to mainstream economists, given the relative cheapness of printing paper notes, or digitally printing Federal Reserve liabilities, a gold-based system is not only unviable from an economic perspective, but also a weirdly costly anachronism. Why bother with physical goods when you can print up a synthetic, largely free alternative? Quite similarly, today the most strident anti-Bitcoin voices fixate on its resource costs, and specifically, its energy consumption. As with gold, the critics allege that Bitcoin's resource burden is not just too high, but entirely a waste, because to them, Bitcoin offers no perceptible utility relative to other monetary and payment systems. As with gold, the constraints imposed by Bitcoin make no sense to Westerners raised on a diet of monetary tinkering and steady debasement. As with gold, hyperbolic projections about future resource costs have come to dominate the debate around Bitcoin. Mora et al., anyone? As with gold, apparently cheap alternative systems like proof of stake, effectively fiat by another name, are held up as costless alternatives. And just like gold, the opportunity costs of the untethered fiat system are not considered in the resource costs debate. The costs of the fiat standard go unchallenged, while the more explicit costs of gold and now Bitcoin are subjected to extreme scrutiny. The debate over the resource costs of gold is critical in understanding the present-day fixation with Bitcoin's energy costs. The rhetoric is the same, only the names and the jargon are substituted. Today's critics talk in calm, worried tones about Bitcoin's concerning ESG characteristics. This sterile corporate speak is, of course, a euphemism for the following. I see no value in Bitcoin and hence consider all costs associated with its production and maintenance wasteful. In light of these similarities, let us wind back the clock and consider the gold resource cost debate. It's a rather delightful contradiction that Bitcoin reaches into the past to propose a monetary order that theorists have long coveted while relying on new technology. At once a techno-utopian project, yet also a reactionary, almost revanchist movement. So let us consider the history of the Bitcoin energy debate, or its deeper abstraction, the hard money resources debate. A remarkable paper that makes these similarities evident is Roger Garrison's 1985 treatise, The Costs of a Gold Standard. Virtually the entire tract could be written with Bitcoin substituted for gold, and its conclusions would hold. In the paper, Garrison argues that considering resource costs in isolation is irrelevant without a discussion of opportunity costs. That is, the costs imposed by a world without gold. The efficiency of the system is a necessary function of the benefits of the price stability and monetary independence of gold. And its costs cannot be considered without reference to these qualities. As Garrison notes, quote, "The effectiveness of the resource cost argument against the gold standard rests on the popular perception that the activities of mining gold, refining it, casting it into bars, or minting it into coins, storing it, and guarding it are collectively wasteful activities, and the implicit assumption that if the gold standard were supplanted by a paper standard, these activities would cease. But making the implicit assumption explicit is enough to demonstrate its falsity. The imposition of a paper standard does not cause gold to lose its monetary value. To believe otherwise is to hold the naive view that the state can repeal the laws of economics. Gold continues to be mined, refined, cast or minted, stored and guarded. The resource costs continue to be incurred. In fact, a paper standard administered by an irresponsible monetary authority may drive the monetary value of gold so high that more resource costs are incurred under the paper standard than would have been incurred under a gold standard. This perspective is elucidating. Whether gold or Bitcoin, in non-totalitarian states, there is no way to reliably inhibit the spontaneous desire of savers to store their wealth outside of sovereign currencies. In 1986, perhaps as a response to Garrison, Friedman hedged his prior position, noting the paradoxical rise in demand for gold under a purely fiat standard. Since the end of Bretton Woods, he mused, even the direct resource cost of the gold and silver accumulated in private hoards may have been as great as or greater than it would have been under an effective gold standard. You can think of this transition from the state linking its currency to the commodity to individuals choosing to hold the commodity directly as a desocialization of the stability afforded by a gold-backed currency. This analogizes to a town removing its exterior walls and gates, forcing the citizens to erect their own makeshift palisades around their compounds. As sovereign currencies have become more unstable since the dissolution of Bretton Woods, almost precisely 50 years ago today, individual savers have increasingly sought out safety in gold and other hard monies. In 1999, the monetary economist Larry White applied a critical eye to Friedman's challenge from the 50s, questioning Friedman's assumption of a full reserve gold world. In a more likely fractional reserve system, such as the ones we have seen in various free banking episodes, for instance, gold reserves would account for a single-digit percentage of the money supply, driving down the necessary resource costs of the commodity. This pragmatic assumption reduces Friedman's resource cost estimates by a factor of 50. Additionally, White supports the idea that gold still imposes resource costs even if you desert the gold standard. He calculated that the acquisition of gold bars and coins by private individuals has indeed been structurally elevated since we entered a fully fiat standard in 1971. In a counterfactual gold standard world, White argues, we would actually require less gold, less extraction, and hence lower resource costs than we do today. In our current world of monetary instability, amid a fraying dollar system, both individual savers and central banks have been buying gold at an increasing rate. Russia now holds more gold than dollar-denominated assets in its reserves. According to data from the World Gold Council, the central banks of China, Turkey, India, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico have all showed noted enthusiasm for the metal in the last decade. And as interest rates stay low and inflation ratchets up, U.S. debt, now mathematically guaranteed to lose the holder money if held to maturity, has become less attractive as a savings device. Led by China and Japan, foreign governments have been net sellers of U.S. treasuries since 2014. Today, the Federal Reserve holds more treasuries than all other foreign governments combined. All of this is to say that, despite the assurances of the soundness of the dollar emanating from Washington, individuals and states are taking a new look at non-state monetary commodities. For gold, this additional demand, prompted by an unstable fiat system, imposes a very real resource cost and inescapable environmental externalities. Approximately 131 terawatt hours of energy is used every year in gold extraction and mining. Bitcoin clocks in at around 76 terawatt hours. As inflation picks up and it becomes increasingly clear that the U.S. government must debauch the dollar in order to finance its growing largesse, the appeal of gold, Keynes's barbarous relic, grows in importance. Yet despite the environmental footprint of gold, few today seriously advocate the banning of gold production. Gold mining is widely distributed worldwide, with the largest single producer nation, China, accounting for only 11% of the new supply. Entrepreneurial gold miners emerge to extract the metal anywhere it is sufficiently dense in the Earth's crust, making global regulation virtually impossible. And gold offers a valid insurance policy against currency debasement, one that billions of individuals worldwide and an increasing number of central banks are taking advantage of. The analogies to Bitcoin should be clear. Much like gold, Bitcoin is an asset with non-discretionary monetary supply dynamics. No one entity can control the supply. In Bitcoin's case, it's not physical properties that define the rate of production, but a credibly committed to supply schedule expressed in code. Like gold, Bitcoin is attractive because it is scarce and cannot be debased. Bitcoin also improves on gold in some critical respects. It's more portable, concealable, and transportable. Strong auditability and cheap verification of inbound transactions mean that Bitcoin is less prone to getting captured by large custodians, which helped doom the gold standard. Clients can always withdraw and self-custody their coins with little difficulty. As with gold, Bitcoin users are happy to pay for the, quote, costs of the monetary system they opt into. The resource costs are not socialized. They are borne solely by holders and transactors. Some externalities exist, but they must be considered relative to the externalities of fiat, which has a disastrous track record. All 56 hyperinflations on record have occurred under conditions of fiat currency. None has taken place on a commodity standard. Gold mining occurs worldwide, as gold is relatively well distributed in the Earth's crust. Bitcoin mining is as of yet more concentrated, but its prospects for continued dispersion look bright. Mining is highly modularizable and can take place anywhere that energy is present, even outside of the electric grid. Like a starfish losing an arm, Bitcoin can survive the loss of large portions of its industrial base without incident. China's recent ban took around 45% of Bitcoin's hash rate offline, but the protocol itself kept ticking along. As a practical consequence of that ban, Bitcoin has no current dependency on a single state. Since Bitcoin mining is a single market, i.e., the protocol pays the same rate per block to miners anywhere, regardless of location, policymakers banning Bitcoin mining locally effectively subsidize the activity elsewhere. Like gold, trying to globally regulate the asset is a fool's errand. Much has been said on the prospects for rendering Bitcoin mining more sustainable, and the industry has been galvanized over the last year. The Bitcoin Mining Council has begun releasing disclosures from constituents. A number of large miners have begun voluntarily disclosing their sustainability and buying offsets for the remainder. The emergence of flared gas mining is a potent near-term lever which could decarbonize Bitcoin mining. But ultimately, Bitcoin mining should be understood similarly to the gold mining industry, a global industry composed of thousands of heterogeneous participants. Some of them are accountable to U.S. capital markets, and hence more inclined to be transparent and sustainable, but a good portion of hash rate will likely always be opaque. Understanding the Bitcoin energy debate as the continuation of the age-old debate about the resource costs of non-state money helps clarify the terms. The reason critics fixate on Bitcoin's energy impact is not its particular rapaciousness, mobilizing against an industry accounting for generously 0.1% of global emissions will not solve the climate crisis, but because they dispute its relevance and merit as a monetary good. Similarly, critics railed against the purportedly high resource cost of the gold standard not because gold was too expensive. As demonstrated, fiat has increased the resource costs imposed by the acquisition of gold, but because they resented the monetary discipline imposed by the gold standard itself. Not once have I encountered a critic of Bitcoin formulating a challenge to Bitcoin's resource costs in a rigorous and data-backed manner. The challenge, were it to appear, would look something like, quote, Bitcoin's kilowatt hours consumed or CO2 emissions per unit of settled or stored value is excessively high relative to the equivalent ratio for Fedwire. Bitcoin's costs are the denominator in the equation of its efficiency, yet the numerator is rarely considered. How often do you hear critics conceding that Bitcoin provides valuable monetary freedom for tens of millions of individuals worldwide, especially those in unstable states lacking meaningful property rights? And with fiat, the denominator, its deleterious effects on society is scarcely ever included in the accounting of its own resource efficiency. Now, if Bitcoin becomes the base money in a neo-gold standard, does it pose more of a threat to the Earth's resources than gold ever did? Doubtful. Bitcoin's annualized issuance rate is 1.7%. Throw in aggressive estimates for fees, and you could push that to 2.1%. The issuance component of Bitcoin's security budget halves every 4 years, with the next halving due in 2024. Unless fees massively increase and keep increasing every 4 years to offset the halvings, they've never held at much more than 200 Bitcoin per day for a sustained period, Bitcoin's security spend will likely decline in Bitcoin terms over the medium and long term. I'm aware that this is a controversial assumption. If Bitcoin reaches parity with gold, as would be presumably necessary for it to serve as specie in a neo-gold standard system, implying a BTC unit price of $579,000 as of today, Bitcoin's resource costs would be effectively identical to those of gold. How is this possible? Well, it's an odd coincidence that gold's issuance rate is almost exactly the same as Bitcoin's in this current halving regime. In 2020, gold equivalent to 1.76% of the above-ground stock was mined. The figure has averaged 1.83% over the last decade. In 2020, gold producers collectively raked in $191 billion through mining, before any costs are factored in, a figure equivalent to 0.2% of global GDP. So even if Bitcoin completely supplants gold as the global monetary substrate of choice, it will only match gold's current resource cost, which again, virtually no one ever complains about. Of course, even in the fever dreams of its biggest fans, Bitcoin isn't likely to hockey stick to gold parity overnight. So if it takes Bitcoin longer than 3 years to achieve parity, the Bitcoin mining industry will likely never match gold mining in terms of economic significance. Layer on the fact that Bitcoin mining is effectively a fully synthetic version of gold mining, taking place only in data centers, requiring no diesel, arsenic, or mercury, and our digital gold looks distinctly more sustainable than its analog counterpart. Gold extraction and refining is a heavy industry that requires the actual manipulation of physical matter, meaning it can never fully mitigate its carbon footprint. By contrast, to decarbonize, Bitcoin miners simply need to direct green power to their machines, which they are already in the process of doing. The purpose of this comparison is not to denigrate gold, but to demonstrate Bitcoin's likely lower resource burden, even under the most optimistic scenario. Regardless, gold's resource costs and ecological externalities, significant though they may be, are clearly worth it. The philosophical divide concerns neither gold, nor Bitcoin, nor fiat. It ultimately reduces down to those who believe that money should be the sole purview of the state, and those who question the state's monetary prudence and look to alternatives. As with gold's resource costs, the energy debate is just a metonymy for this more fundamental question. As for Friedman, he ended up dramatically reversing himself on the resource cost critique later in life. In his 1986 tract, The Resource Cost of Irredeemable Paper Money, he points out that fiat has very real costs, namely, the exorbitance of unstable prices and inflation. Quote, I took it for granted that the real resource costs of producing irredeemable paper money was negligible, consisting only of the cost of paper and printing. Experience under a universal irredeemable paper money standard makes it crystal clear that such an assumption, while it may be correct with respect to the direct cost to the government of issuing fiat outside money, is false for society as a whole, and is likely to remain so unless and until a monetary structure emerges under an irredeemable paper standard that provides a high degree of long-run price-level predictability. In the paper, Friedman provides a simple example of the resource costs of a fiat regime, the new requirement by firms to hedge foreign exchange exposure. As he notes, foreign exchange futures were virtually unheard of until the link between the dollar and gold was severed. Under the first Bretton Woods system, the dollar was a fixed weight of gold, and other currencies were linked to the dollar. Once that tether was broken, economic agents were forced to participate in the foreign currency markets. But few have dared to quantify these costs. He ends the paper with the following entreaty. I don't know of any attempt to measure the real resource costs of an irredeemable paper currency and to compare such costs with the real resource costs of a commodity currency. That is clearly a much-needed research project. Today, 35 years on from his request, and 50 years after the total collapse of Bretton Woods, it might be time to revisit Friedman's question once again. All right, that closes out Nick Carter's The Bitcoin Energy Debate is a Modern Reprise of the Gold Resource Cost Debate. And this is, well, actually, no, before we get into it, let's go ahead and hit our sponsor real quick. And I want to do a short guy's take on this one. So someone who does some regular work for me decided to get into Bitcoin after I kept planting seeds in our discussions. But instead of using Swan Bitcoin like I recommended, he put $1,000 in all at once. The price was $62,000 when he did. For a couple of months, the price dropped steeply and stayed kind of low, so now he's stressed and doesn't want to put any more in until, you know, he is back in the profitable zone. Yet these are the exact key moments to take advantage of, to dollar cost average. Now, had he done $100 a week over 3 months with Swan Bitcoin, he'd have invested the exact same amount, except that he'd already be solidly profitable because he bought 100 at 62,000, then some at 50,000, then 46,000, then 39,000, and here we're back up today at 50,000. He wouldn't be stressing right now. He'd already be happy. He wouldn't have to worry about when to buy again or when to sell. He just sets the frequency on Swan Bitcoin and it runs. He wouldn't be unhappy about the dips. They'd just be a great opportunity to lower his cost basis. SwanBitcoin.com/guy is the way to buy and save in Bitcoin. And then there's Swan Private for those who want the full concierge service to walk them through everything in their first purchase, answer any questions about Bitcoin, setting up their hardware wallet, and all understanding how to use it. And get direct access to the amazing team at Swan for all their Bitcoin-related questions. Check it out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. You know what the takeaway from this article is, in my opinion? And I think this is what Nick Carter was getting at. Is the debate about Bitcoin's energy cost. The cost that it takes to make Bitcoin a secure, sound monetary instrument is not a debate about cost. It is a debate about the value of what it is achieving. It's a debate about sound money. The people who think Bitcoin wastes energy are the same people who think gold is a waste of energy because they think fiat money, they think manipulated money is better than sound money. That is the debate. It is on the merit of a money that is able to be manipulated by a centralized party, by some group that runs the money, some group that is able to print the money arbitrarily, or even the false security of something like proof of stake, where they think that they're actually getting the same thing that they get. Like, and generally, I think that's what people think with fiat, is that, oh, well, you have the government's assurances that they'll manage a proper monetary policy. And I think that's a lot of what proof of stake ends up being, is these promises that the handful of richest people on the network won't change the rules and they won't modify it on their behalf, but it will not be decentralized consensus. We have a, or it won't be an independent consensus. It will be absolutely subject to all of the vulnerabilities of proof of stake. And essentially all you can do is move the problem around so that it's either hard to see or hard to get to, but it's essentially axiomatic. It's in the very nature of the problem that if your security, your sense of truth, is determined by the history that is determined by the truth. Or said a different way, if the history is what's determining who owns what, and who owns what determines who gets to say what the history is or which history is valid, you've got a circular problem. The cost, the quote-unquote stake for the security of the history, for the cost to reverse the history, cannot be determined within the consensus. All you've done is, all you end up doing is moving the problem around. It just makes it harder to see where the problem is, much like where, when you start manipulating interest rates, like, the economy still is subject to all the same economic principles that fail at a micro level, but at a macro level, it's just really hard to see where those problems occur because you've got so many steps removed from the fact that somebody has cut down trees to someone building the house. And if you've got debt instruments and you've got CDCs and you've got futures markets and you've got contracts and people building decks and stuff right now, and a certain amount of lumber on the market, and then you've got other countries that are delivering lumber that are working in different currencies and have different interest rates in their local economies, et cetera, et cetera. All you do is obfuscate the fact, the simple fact at the end of the day, that you can't build a house today with trees that have yet to be cut down. If we're cutting down the trees tomorrow, you can't start putting the house together today because you need the wood. You have to have the tree already cut down to build it. That's the same fallacy that we run into in economics all the time, that governments consistently either obscure away or try to pretend doesn't exist because they can manipulate the money. This is very similar to the thinking in proof of stake, in my opinion, that what they are doing is trying to make it seem as if there is a cost, but if it's determined within the system, that the actual truth of the network, who owns what, is determined by who owns what, then it is simply not going to be secure. I think there's a very, very fundamental problem that cannot be worked around. And I think that's why even in Ethereum, one of the Ethereum developers said on, what was it? I think it was a Let's Talk Bitcoin episode, maybe? I can't remember. But they basically argued, that said, oh, well, you know, we have to accept some degree of centralization and make these trade-offs to get these features, and that's okay because Ethereum is openly making that trade-off. But central signers, to have the Ethereum Foundation or some select group of people signing checkpoints as part of the consensus mechanism, just means that they're the ones that decide what the history is. Who is being punished and who isn't being punished is a product of those signatures and nothing else. Anyway, I don't want to go on too much about proof of stake because it's a little bit of a misnomer in this, but it's side related, right? Like, this is the idea of a fiat standard versus a gold standard, proof of stake versus proof of work. Is the cost real? Is there real security? Is there real scarcity? Or is it someone else determining what that scarcity is by their degree of authority? And that's what I think proof of stake is. It is essentially a system of turning ownership into authority. Whereas proof of work is simply a real world cost to the editing It's essentially an independent history. The analogy I used in a good example or a good episode, I think, on this topic. Well, first off, there's a Shitcoin Insider episode for those of you who have been begging us to do another Shitcoin Insider episode. I'm so sorry it's taken so long. I think we're like 6 months and it's just been blank on that RSS feed. But we have so many ideas, it's just been procrastination on top of procrastination. But we do have a episode coming that is explicitly on this, and we kind of go into it in detail. But also, there's recently on Bitcoin Audible, not too recently, a couple months, I think, is the treatise on altcoins, which really gets into, there's a whole section about proof of stake, and we talk about that a lot. But also keep an eye out for the Shitcoin Insider episode. It's probably be titled like Proof of What or something. I don't know. But I think the analogy that I use is proof of work is a literal force field of energy. Everyone collectively contributes to this force field. And no matter who is participating in the force field, everyone has to spend the exact same amount of energy to get into the force field. Like, it's even if I am the one that's producing 90% of the force field's energy, I still have to re-spend that 90% in order to go backwards, go through the force field to change something in the history of the system. So it's like an actual energy cost that is external to the system that the digital world is proving the cost exists. Whereas proof of stake is like having the 5 or 6 most wealthy people in the system to stand around the system with guns and saying that they're not going to compromise the system because, you know, there's a couple other people with guns and maybe they'll shoot each other. But it's essentially trusting that the wealthiest people in the system will choose to defend the money and not corrupt the system for everyone else. But that obviously comes with a lot of very clear vulnerabilities, which is why you almost always, I genuinely don't think there's one that doesn't have this, is checkpoints. Because essentially you can have a grinding attack. Is if your keys, it's supposed to say that, you know, the amount of stake that you have, the amount that you have invested in the system is how much quote unquote authority you have. But maybe you sold it all today for Bitcoin. You still have the keys. Let's just use Ethereum because they want to go proof of stake. Let's say you own 70% of Bitcoin, or excuse me, own 70% of Ethereum because you pre-mined it and gave it to yourself. Well, you're highly invested in the system, but what if you sold it all for Bitcoin this afternoon? Well, you still have a history where you are still holding a key for 70% of Ethereum's history. And you can print a new history forward from that point where you have 70% of the authority, and that history says that you didn't sell your keys, or you didn't sell your Ethereum, excuse me, that transaction wasn't included in this alternative history. And then to mitigate that, you put in a little random number generator so that they don't know whether or not they're going to be able to produce the next quote unquote block that favors them versus somebody else. Well, then what do you have? Now you have a proof of work system, because now they're just going to grind through all of the blocks. They're going to trick the random number generator until they get a random number that favors them. And they're going to grind through blocks until they have an alternative history that does favor them and doesn't have the transaction where they sold all of that Ethereum. And then you need a little mitigation for that. And then you need a mitigation for the next thing. You're constantly obscuring away and trying to move the problem, move the goalpost to a different place. But fundamentally, what you have is a cost within the system's truth that is attempting to determine the truth. And I really just think that's kind of fundamentally not going to work, at least unless it's centralized. I mean, if you have some trusted party that's signing checkpoints, well, then yeah. But then at that point, it's like, what's the point of proof of stake? You know, it's kind of like putting lipstick on a pig. You want it to look good, and you want it to quote unquote feel decentralized. But what you're doing is you just have somebody signing on what the official history is. Why not drop the facade unless you're just trying to trick people? And you can still run a system like that you could still do something interesting and have some interesting features, but you're given the illusion that you're not trusting somebody, and you absolutely are. Anyway, this isn't what the article was really about. The debate with it's funny too about this article with Nick Carter here is he's kind of digging up something that I wasn't in that. I mean, I don't really know anything about the gold resource cost debate. You know, it makes sense that that was there, and I guess I've come across it at times with reading economic history and stuff. Like, it was brought up. But I didn't know really how prevalent it was, and it's just kind of funny to see that this debate has just always been this debate as to whether or not it's a good thing to be able to manipulate the money supply, because it's really hard with gold, and it's really costly, and that's frustrating, and that wastes energy. Why not just have a fiat standard where we can just print arbitrarily? Same thing with Bitcoin. Why are we going through all this work? Why do we want real, measurable integrity for the system? If, of course, they even understand Bitcoin well enough to know that that's even what the hell it's doing, it probably to them just looks like nothing, because they both, A, don't think sound money is valuable, but then B, don't have the slightest clue how Bitcoin works or why it actually uses energy, like what the purpose of the energy within the Bitcoin system actually is, how it is that proof of work specifically creates distributed consensus. Whereas when you start talking about how much energy the cruise industry takes, which is pretty comparable to Bitcoin, they don't care because cruises are fun. Look, you have a pool and everybody drinks and it's great for old people. And then, I need dry clothes. So the fact that dryers in the US alone, just clothes dryers, use more than the Bitcoin network. Well, we're not going to argue about that because I don't have to hang my clothes up. That's a real pain in the ass. So if it's something that's directly valuable to them, then okay, they're not going to be worried about it because it benefits them. The thing is that flatly they're selfish. They think value is meaningless if it's not directly valuable to them. If they can't come up with a reason in which they would want it specifically in their life, well, then nobody else should even have the right to have a thing that they don't understand as valuable. Essentially, the entire world is limited to their level of ignorance as to what is worth something and what isn't. And, you know, this is where I have problem with altcoins and shitcoins, altcoiners and shitcoiners, is we can debate all day about whether or not any of these projects are viable, whether or not proof of stake is going to work, but I don't believe that you don't have the right to try it. Of course, you have the right to fork Bitcoin and double the block size and put in a different script and try something stupid or maybe smart or interesting and make your own money. Like I don't care. Like, I'm still going to give my fair opinion about those things. But it's funny how much the mindset of those specific, specifically the fiat and the proof of stake and the proof of work is a waste of energy sort of mindset, even in crypto, they will pontificate all day that Bitcoin maxis are toxic and they're stupid and that we're all in this together and we shouldn't fight each other. But the second something is beneficial to Bitcoin and not altcoins or shitcoins, they will absolutely slit Bitcoin's throat to get what they want for crypto. This recent legislation push, when proof of work specifically was removed from the wording of the bill regarding broker, it is fascinating how quickly and how soundly everyone in the crypto movement started absolutely trashing Bitcoin. We are not in this together if that's how you behave. And they have the exact same problem, that they don't even know why proof of work matters. They don't even understand how it is to get distributed, secure, independent, distributed consensus. Now, I've grossly generalized here. This isn't the entire quote-unquote crypto market. I know plenty of people who are at least open to discussion, and I certainly know Bitcoiners who are in the reverse, that they actually think that all crypto and altcoins or whatever should like be outlawed or whatever it is. So this is no perfectly one-sided discussion. but I was just shocked by the sheer volume of people in quote-unquote crypto who were so eager, who will basically beg for Bitcoiners to not trash them constantly, but then will instantly and immediately throw Bitcoin fully under the bus the second an opportunity is available. If it will help their shitcoin, they will absolutely 100% talk about how Bitcoin and proof of work is the most horrible thing for the world ever. And this all comes back to whether or not we have secure money. Does this create sound money? And I don't mean it sound like is the monetary policy very low inflation or very high inflation? I mean sound in the sense, does this have high integrity? Can this be changed? Is this an immutable monetary policy, a reliable monetary policy? Or is this a small group of people determining what the past is, signing over what the actual truth is versus the approved truth versus the unapproved truth? And is this a real cost where we know how secure the system is because it can't be cheated? There is no way around it. It simply is. The cost has either been paid or it has not. That's the real discussion. That's the real debate. What is the value of a currency, of a money that cannot be manipulated? And when we are comparing monetary systems, when we are comparing monetary networks, is it a secure, decentralized, independent monetary policy for some digital asset? Or is it an arbitrary, constantly changing monetary policy that's decided by a handful of people who are quote-unquote in charge? And in that explains why the fiat apologists hated and demonized the costs of gold and are now doing exactly the same for Bitcoin. And it is so much why many in crypto demonize proof of work and Bitcoin as well. They simply do not value sound, incorruptible money. So any cost, whatever, to secure it simply isn't worth it because they don't think it's worth anything. But that's why the conversation is about whether or not it's good to have a secure money, to have a money that is truly independent and cannot be corrupted by some central party. That is the framing that gives us the high ground. That is the argument that is easy to win. And that is the one that makes them have to apologize or has to excuse all of the horrific things that are the result of the fiat system. That is the debate that we want. So that'll close us out for today. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks to Nick Carter for this amazing piece in Bitcoin Magazine, as always. Swan Bitcoin for the best automatic Bitcoin savings plan. And the Bitbox O2 from Shift Crypto, the best hardware wallet to secure your keys. Check them both out at guyswan.com and join the Bitcoin revolution. You will learn everything about it right here on Bitcoin Audible. Bitcoin is the light at the end of the tunnel. It is the antidote to digital tyranny. It is our way to pull the plug on the global reset, our exit to the fiat fiasco. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. This has been Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.